King Midas often has been told. Everything he laid his hands on was turned to solid gold.
Welcome back to Downtown 431 on a Friday afternoon. Our next guest is a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter who's sold millions of records through the years. As the lead vocalist for Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and as a solo artist, he has got a terrific new album out called Say Something. That is King Midas, one of the songs from the album. We are so happy to be joined this afternoon by David Clayton Thomas. David, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Rich. Good to be here.
Man, I love the new album so much. And, let's say, you don't pull any punches on this one.
Well, we decided to make the record say something, and it does.
It sure does, yeah. King Midas, Dear Mr. Obama is a terrific cut, and I think my favorite one because, well, it sums it all up. The circus is about as apt a tune as you'll get for what we're experiencing these days.
Yeah, that's getting a lot of airplay down here in Toronto. Where are you calling from?
We're in Bangor, Maine.
Oh, yeah. Lovely place. I've been up through there many times.
Well, this is not a new thing for you. You have always, in your music, spoken about what's going on in the world. Part of that, I have to assume, goes back to your Greenwich Village days and your love of the music of Bob Dylan.
Absolutely. Dylan was a huge influence. And Dylan, I heard in the coffee shops, you know, in the 60s, and he was singing the same things in his music that we were talking about over in the coffee shops. And in those days, it was very political, of course. It was the Vietnam War, and it was kids being drafted, and, you know, it was a whole revolution around. And the music was coming out of New York in those days. You're an East Coaster, you could appreciate this. When the music was headquartered in New York, it was potent. It was very powerful. It moved out to L.A. in the mid-70s, and it became background music for a dance video, basically.
Well,
so we've tried to go back to that kind of ethic where the music actually could say something to a generation.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about that because, again, so much of what passes for popular music today is product. And certainly there's nothing wrong with selling a lot of records, but how important is it for artists who are given this platform to say something?
Well, it's all we've got left. Of course, nobody's selling records anymore. Nobody, but nobody. We've been Spotify'd out of existence. And, of course, Spotify is not paying the artists, so that's one stream of income gone. Now, of course, with this pandemic, they've taken our concerts away. So I'm in a community here of Toronto with some incredibly creative musicians. They're all out of work right now. So all we've got left really is our voices, isn't it?
Absolutely. Your story is a fascinating one. You've written about it. You've spoken about it before. But, I mean, your childhood was, in many ways, right out of Charles Dickens, what you went through.
Well, that's a nice way of putting it. Why, did Charles Dickens get beat up when he was a kid?
Well, there were some rough patches along the way there. Well, and you sing about it on the new album, too. Your song about your time at the Burwash Industrial Farm is incredibly powerful.
Yeah, they were playing that on Jazz FM last night. A disc jockey phoned me up and said, put it on Jazz FM right now. And they were playing it on Jazz FM. They like it a lot, which is funny because it's not a jazz song at all.
How did you come to the attention of Ronnie Hawkins?
You know, when I first hit Toronto, we had I think we called the Strip here in Toronto, and it was a string of bars that went maybe 20 blocks up the middle of Toronto on Yonge Street, and there was perhaps 20 different nightclubs to work in, and the king of the Strip was Ronnie Hawkins. Ronnie was at a place called Le Coq d'Or, which was right in the middle of the Strip, and in the afternoons they would have matinees. The matinees, they didn't serve liquor, so kids could come in. So all the young wannabe musicians would show up waiting to see Robbie and Levon, you know, and because it was the Hawks, later to become the band. And they were our heroes. And I just kept bugging Ronnie, let me get up and sing a song. And he did, and he offered me a job. And that was my first paying gig.
And am I right that it was an appearance on the old television series Hullabaloo that gave you the taste of New York City and made you want to move there?
Oh, absolutely. And it lasted for 40 years. We went down to play on Hullabaloo. We had a number one hit record in Canada, which got us a shot on Hullabaloo on NBC in the States, hosted by Paul Anka. And I had 3 days there while we were filming the show, and I hung out in Greenwich Village a lot. And in those days, the entire music industry was headquartered in Greenwich Village. Mm. 8 square blocks of downtown Manhattan. You could walk down the street on a Saturday night, and Carole King's playing here, James Taylor's over here, Jimi Hendrix is over here. You know, it was so vital. It was so incredibly creative. I couldn't wait to get back to it. When I did get back to it, about a year later, I basically stayed out of work for about a year playing to basket houses in New York. And that's where I met the guys in Blood, Sweat, and Tears. They're all playing the same little clubs in Greenwich Village.
And so you knew him a little bit, but was it Judy Collins that really pushed to get you together with the group after Al Kooper had left?
Well, I don't know. That's the rumor that's come down through history. I knew these guys anyway, and one night Bobby Colombi came in, and yes, Judy Collins was with him, and Jim Fielder, the bass player, and Steve Katz, the guitar player. But they all knew me. We'd all played gigs around the village. It wasn't like Judy said, oh, I got this singer I want you to hear. You know, they all knew me anyway. And we hung out for a while, and I didn't think much more of it. And a few weeks later, I had gone back to Toronto because they didn't have a visa, and I was invited to leave. I went back to Toronto, and Bobby Colombi called me. And I knew about the band Blood, Sweat, and Tears. They played upstairs from me in a club I played in the village. And he said, well, the band broke up. Al Cooper's gone. And he took half the band with him. And we've got 4 guys and a recording contract left. You want to come down and sing with us? And I said, you bet. I was on a plane in an hour. I was you bet I do. So I came down to New York and went right back to Greenwich Village, and we got a little loft up above the Cafe Agogo on Bleecker Street and started rehearsing and putting a new band together.
We had Al Kooper on the show a couple of years ago, and he's a very interesting guy, and you've never had anything negative to say about him, but what you brought to the band was, first of all, those lead vocalist chops, but also that blues and jazz sensibility.
Well, vocal style was the main bone of contention with Cooper and the band. These guys were jazz musicians. Half of them had master's degrees. They came out of Juilliard and Manhattan and Eastman. And their idea of, they grew up with singers like Tony Bennett and Ray Charles and Aretha, you know, singers, real singers. And they had a problem with Al. Al was more of a rock singer. Never had any problems with Al. I've been answering questions about Al Kooper my whole life, but I don't know him. He was gone when I got there, so never really met him that much, but I understand that the band wanted a real singer. And a lot of people were in line for the gig. They talked to Laura Nero about it. Steve Stills was considered. And I ended up with the gig. So... And Cooper basically said, I'm going to be the lead singer, or I leave. And then the band said, okay, bye-bye. That was it.
And you guys were really, I think back in the late 60s, early 70s, to me, you were the quintessential New York band. You represented so much of what the city was about.
Absolutely. I'm glad you picked up on that, and I've said it myself many times. People ask about the sound of Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Oh, it was the horns. Oh, it was the jazz rock. It was the combination of the... No, no, no. It was New York City. That's what that band sounded like. The guys that played in that band, not only most of them were graduates of, like I said, Juilliard and Eastman and Manhattan School of Music, but a New York working musician, he will play a Broadway show in the afternoon, go and play Latin music in Spanish Harlem on the weekends, and at night go and play jazz in the village, you know? They could play anything and everything. And the sound of the city, the first time I heard this band play, I basically said, this is not a West Coast band. This is not L.A. with its surfer surfer. You know what I mean? This is right off the streets of New York. Hard charging. You could hear Broadway in it. You could hear Lincoln Center. You could hear the Village Vanguard. It was all there. It was New York.
Well, you guys were doing well over 200 shows a year. That had to wear, like, for the musicians, they can do that, because you've said many of them might play different gigs in a day, but for the lead vocalist, boy, that had to be wearing.
Well, yeah, you know, the only thing comparable, of course, is the lead trumpet player. And the lead trumpet book in the Blood, Sweat, and Tears was created by Lou Soloff, one of the greatest lead trumpet players ever to live. The late Lou Soloff, my buddy. But if Lou's lip went out, and it did, because it's punishing to play lead trumpet,
right,
hitting high Gs in a stadium, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And we didn't have the kind of sound systems and ear monitors and stuff that we have today. Well, if the lip went out, they sent in a sub for a couple of nights. Lou had a sub. Everybody in the band had a sub except me. You know, if my voice went out, I either had to go on or we canceled the date.
Well, you have been incredibly productive as a solo artist as well. But basically, for more than a dozen years or so, you've been putting together a new solo album just about once a year.
Pretty much. I was one of the frustrations and. Over the years, Blood, Sweat, and Tears was very, very good to me. I made a bunch of money, and I put my kids through college and had a nice home and everything, a nice car. But it had turned into a touring band. It had turned into basically a tribute band. The original guys were all gone, and they hadn't been in a recording studio in 30 years. There was no interest. You know, they were turning out millions of dollars a year on the road, and that's what it became. And there was no interest either in the management or in the band or anybody to make new music. Me, I'm a songwriter, and if I can't write, I'm gonna go off the wall. I mean, that's what I do. So once I left, it finally made up my mind in about 2004 that I was going to leave. I gave my notice, and I played out about a year of contracts that still had to be played. As soon as I moved up here, I went right in the studio because I had a ton of music that I wanted to record. And I recorded three albums in the first 3 years, all new original material.
Well, it's terrific music. The new album, Say Something, I think it's some of the best work of your career, both as a songwriter and as a vocalist here. It's really terrific stuff. And
that was a fun record to make, too, you know, because you kind of just get to sit back and snipe at things that really piss you off.
And did you bring in, basically, you brought in your guys that play with you on the road to work on the recording, right?
Well, more than that, these guys are my lifetime friends. Lou Pamonti was in Blood, Sweat, and Tears back in the 80s. You know, we've worked together, known each other our whole lives. So I know these guys. These are my buddies, guys I hang out with, even if we're not doing a gig.
Well, we hope you can get back out there and perform live again soon. I have to ask you, I heard an interview you did not too long ago. You bought a new car. Have you had a chance to take it out and use it yet?
You know what? I just decided I'm going to go out. It's going to be a beautiful day here in Toronto tomorrow. And I'm just going to go out for a drive because there's not a lot of traffic out there. And I don't need a destination. I'm just going to point it out on the highway and let her go for a while.
That sounds like a great plan.
Because, you know, we've been pretty much locked down here for the last month. All of our gigs have been canceled for the year. Of course, nobody's working. It's a big shame, really. I'm hurting for the city of Toronto. We have one of the great concert halls in the world here called Massey Hall. Mm. And they just put $50 million into renovating the old lady. And because she's 100 years old or more. And she's due to open this summer, but not now. And I wonder how long it's going to be before you can put 3,000 people sitting shoulder to shoulder in Massey Hall again, if ever.
Well, it's uncertain times for all of us here, but I tell you, it makes me feel a lot better to hear your music and hear that great voice of yours and hear these songs that speak some important truths. The album is called Say Something. David Clayton Thomas, such a treat for us. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Rich, my pleasure. You take care now.
You too. On the way into the break, let's hear a little more from David's new album, Say Something. This one is called The Circus. We'll be right back.
president pays off a porn star while the senator steals a kiss. Who could invent such a story? You just can't make up stuff like this. Who could produce such a movie? Even Hollywood can't compare. It's a Barnum and Bailey production, a high wire act in the air. Oh, welcome, my friends, to the circus. Get your tickets.